it's a bit jargony, but the best way of describing it is kind of longitudinal research, i.e. it's not like a usability test where you get a user, well, in the old days, into a lab. Obviously, these days, it's all remote, where you're testing, let's say, a prototype for an hour in depth with an individual one-on-one or kind of two-on-one for a sort of snapshot of their feedback. What you want to do is capture their feedback over a period of time. So it kind of goes back. The first question you need to ask yourself is, what do you want to learn? Because certainly not every research question is answered with a diary study by any shape or form.
Hey, Experiment Nation. It is Tracy, and I am joined by a special guest. His name is Mike Green, and he runs his own podcast that will definitely appeal to the user researchers in here. I have checked it out. I love it, so highly recommend, but I will let Mike take the floor and tell us a bit about himself and his podcast. So Mike, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Tracy. Lovely to be here. Good to be chatting. So I'm Mike. I'm a freelance user research lead based in the UK, and I work mainly with public sector clients over the last few years. Since I've been a contractor, I've been dealing with lots of big government ministries in the UK, and I have a public sector clients at the moment that I'm working with. And as you said, I also have a podcast. So the podcast is Understanding Users. It's a UX podcast aimed at UX designers, researchers, product managers, kind of digital folk in general, talking about digital transformation and basically user-centered design, how we go about building products in a user-centered way, and the challenges we all face doing that. So it's available on Google, Spotify, Amazon, Apple, usual places. So feel free to check it out.
Yeah, please do. And also, the fact that you work public service, I'm sure there's a lot of extra challenges that you deal with that are maybe not as easily spotted in the private sector. Can you speak a bit more to that?
Yeah, it's a really good point. What's interesting is actually, and I've said this kind of elsewhere, that in terms of the British government early on, about a decade or so back, the British government identified problems with the way it procures IT and delivers large-scale IT projects. Not to say they're all perfect now, but it set up this thing called the GDS, the Government Digital Service, which was designed to kind of embed digital delivery best practice across government, basically to save taxpayer money, to make processes more efficient. The upshot of that is that actually over the last 10 years, lots and lots of really good digital delivery work has been done right across the British government. Awesome. So things like, you know, renewing your passport, applying for tax credits, applying for doctor's appointments, all of that kind of stuff. People sort of say, oh, gov.uk is quite good. You know, it's surprising. And I'm like, well, having worked with many teams kind of on those sort of pieces of work, that's not an accident. It's because lots and lots of people, digital experts, you know, from a whole variety of disciplines have spent a lot of time and effort ensuring that the services are built with users in mind. Because, you know, as the analogy I always use, unlike trainers where you can, you know, you go onto Google and you've got a dozen different companies that you can buy trainers from, if you're trying to get a passport or you're trying to tax your car, there's only one person you can do it. You know, only one place you can go, and that's the government. So it's really important. So in terms of accessibility, people with kind of sight issues, people with motor issues, that these digital services are built with the entire community in mind. So actually, yes, there are other challenges to your point around, you know, budgetary, procurement issues, kind of doing everything in a taxpayer centric way.
But red tape, I'm sure.
Red tape, exactly, exactly. But actually, I've stayed in, you know, public sector for quite a few years because I feel like it's A, it's good experience, and B, it's actually in some ways the better way of doing things. Not to say it's perfect, but in many ways it's an exemplar of how it should be done. And actually, other countries have copied the British government in many ways in terms of doing it.
Nice. That was pretty illuminating. I look at my spouse's experience working public sector for our provincial government in Canada, and I look at it and I'm like, I can't deal with this. That's good that at least that's a bit more streamlined in the UK. Now, just in preparation for this episode, you gave me a lot of really cool topics that we can discuss related to user research. I am a big user research fan myself. And you mentioned one particular method that I've never used myself personally, so I want to ask you a lot of questions about it. And that would be diary studies.
Sure.
I just don't hear that term a lot. So can you describe to me and to our listeners who haven't heard of a diary study what that actually is?
So, yeah, absolutely. So I suppose, and it's a bit jargony, but the best way of describing it is kind of longitudinal research, i.e. it's not like a usability test where you get a user, well, in the old days, into a lab. Obviously, these days, it's all remote, where you're testing, let's say, a prototype for an hour in depth with an individual one-on-one or kind of two-on-one for a sort of snapshot of their feedback. What you want to do is capture their feedback over a period of time. So it kind of goes back. The first question you need to ask yourself is, what do you want to learn? Because certainly not every research question is answered with a diary study by any shape or form. Mm-hmm. But where, you know, for example, behavior over a period of time, if you want to baseline behavior, if you want to test a new product or service and see if the behavior modifies, you know, attitudinal responses. So if you want to see how, you know, citizens, users how are they feeling at particular points in time, a diary study allows you to do that. And there's different ways you can do that. So it's normally run over, you know, 1 or 2 weeks. I think 2 weeks is kind of the sweet spot. The longer you run it, the less likely you are to have the greater the level of attrition, probably. Mm-hmm. The shorter you are, the kind of harder it is to get solid insights. Mm-hmm. But I mean, there's one particular example I can talk about of a client I had a couple of years back. It was in the middle of the pandemic, actually. And it was quite a high priority piece of work for the government. And the department I worked with wanted some feedback on a particular service they wanted to launch. And I was concerned that we didn't have enough clear user insight before, you know, the taxpayer started, on behalf of the taxpayer, lots of money was spent on this particular solution. So I suggested we run a diary study. So basically we had a selection of families, and over a period of 2 weeks, we kind of gathered feedback from them pretty much every other day. To gather to trying out this new solution to see how they found the experience, basically. Mm-hmm. And the way we did that was, you know, we did a setup call. So to kind of build the rapport with the family, to introduce myself, introduce what we were up to up front, I would do a kind of Zoom call with each family. And there were, let's say, kind of, I can't remember, half a dozen families, I think possibly eight families, something like that, to explain what we're doing and get the setup done. And then I would send them out an SMS message, and we used the government SMS facility, which was nice and anonymous because it wasn't coming from my individual phone. It was coming from, you know, a government phone number, to prod them and remind them. And in that reminder, there was a Google Forms link. And basically all they had to do was basically click on the link, fill in the form. And the form was, you know, intentionally, another kind of tip for diary studies is keep the form as simple as possible. Mm-hmm. So that you're not, you know, again, the longer you make it, the more complicated they make it, the higher the likelihood of people just going, I can't be bothered with this.
Yeah.
So literally, I think we had 3 or 4 questions, bang, bang, bang. I don't think there was even any, well, there might have been one free text field. It was mainly kind of multiple choice or Likert scales. And then to do that every few days over a couple of weeks. And then we had a final wrap up call at the end of the 2 weeks to go through with them, kind of, you know, thanks very much. And obviously the beauty of doing it like that was we were gathering insight as we were going. So we could do the analysis based on the form submissions they were providing. So that by the time we did the final wrap up call, we had already kind of identified questions that we wanted to ask and areas we wanted to probe.
That's cool. That sounds kind of like a mix of a survey with, not a user test, because I'm sure you're not actually observing live behavior, but there's definitely that level of participation that you wouldn't see just from strictly a survey. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, the reason they're called diary studies is in the olden days, pre-digital, they were literally diaries. You know, so this kind of ethnographic research style has been around a long time. You know, digital can't claim any credit for that. It's just that, you know, rather than writing in a diary, sort of dear diary daily entry, we now have the tools to be able to do something similar, but in the digital realm. And, you know, Google Forms is one tool. There's endless, the survey tools, there's all sorts of capture tools. There's, you know, Google Docs, there's wikis you could do, there's SMS. But for our purposes, you know, and I think that's another important point, is the kind of ethical and accessibility issues need to be taken into account, because we were dealing with, let's say, a vulnerable group who were, you know, most of them suffering significant financial hardship. Mm-hmm. And the tools had to be as simple and as low cost, and the process had to be as simple as possible. Mm-hmm. We also incentivized them, which is another kind of key point to mention. Again, the chances are you're better off, you're more likely to have a successful outcome if you incentivize participants. And then it comes down to, well, how do you incentivize them? Do you incentivize them just up front? Do you incentivize them at the end? Because that poses different issues, because if you incentivize them up front, then the chances are they might drop out and disappear and you've lost your money and you've got no insight. If you incentivize them at the end, there's the chances are that they're just going to give you what they think they want you to hear so that they get the money. So I think what we did from memory is we split it. So we did a payment up front and a payment at the end, just to sort of try and spread the risk and still gather rich insights.
Do you remember which group was more likely to complete the study?
As in?
With the incentive, where?
It's a good question. No, I mean, I would always, like, you know, with classic usability testing, where in the olden days we used to bring people into a lab and we'd pay them. We would always do that afterwards. Mm-hmm. So I think I would certainly err on the, version of that. But at the same time, as I said, kind of the longer the diary study, a week or 2 weeks is quite a long time. Mm-hmm. You know, you're asking for people to commit. I think the sort of the academic literature talks about kind of 7 to 10 minutes a day maximum. Okay. If you're asking people to do more than that for the sake of a, I don't know, let's say £20, £50, $50 Amazon voucher, you're not going to get that. People are not going to want to get that by doing hours and hours of input. So it's got to be as simple as possible.
This is Romo Santiago from Experiment Nation. Every week we share interviews with and conference sessions by our favorite conversion rate optimizers from around the world. So if you like this video, smash that like button and consider subscribing. It helps us a bunch. Now back to the episode.
These are very good considerations that I'm sure go into your process of planning a diary study.
Yeah.
What else would you consider as key considerations in that planning and designing stage for the diary study? Like, do you often find you have to consider a diary study versus another research method? When would you choose a diary study over another method? And just, what does that planning and design stage look like for you?
Yeah, I mean, well, as always with any kind of research, the planning stage is vital. And it always goes back to, you know, the teams I work with are bored of hearing me say it, but it's kind of like, what do you want to learn? You always, always, always should start with that question, because that will dictate the method you use. Mm-hmm. It will dictate the time scale, the budget, you know, the number of people involved, all of that kind of stuff. So certainly for you know, all sorts of outcomes, a diary study is not applicable, but where it is, so as I was saying before, whether it's kind of, you know, a longer term, you want to basically track behavior and or kind of feeling, attitude over time, that's really where a diary study comes into its own, rather than a bespoke kind of test of a new product. So I think, yeah, start with what do you want to learn, and then other tips, things like, you know, regular contact with participants is key. So that's one of the reasons I always do the kind of rapport building kind of intro at the beginning, just to introduce myself. So even though we're doing it remote, and because obviously in the course of the diary study, they're not seeing me or talking to me, it's purely coming to them via SMS or, you know, email or whatever it might be, and they're filling in this form remotely. So I think it's important that they know who they're dealing with, what the purpose of the session is. And as always, you know, what's like the good research content, informed consent, you know, what's going to be done with the data, yeah. Who's going to see it? Is it going to be attributable to them? You know, probably not, hopefully not, so that they can feel free to speak candidly and anonymously. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is, of course, accessibility issues, as I mentioned. So if you're dealing with vulnerable users, you know, whether they be older, you know, with physical or mental disabilities, all of that needs to be considered, because that should inform how you design your study.
So important. Yes, absolutely so important. So let's say you've decided you are ready to make a diary study. Where do you start? I know that there's a form involved, and I'm sure there's communication with your participants involved, but really, just where do you start?
The step after deciding you want to do a diary study, I suppose, really is the recruitment piece. And that's something that exercises user researchers and always has done. You know, how do you then find the people and get them to agree to take part in this? So, you know, do you send out an email to throw the net out wide and get people to kind of reply to you if they want to take part? I think that from memory, that's what we did. And obviously, then you're the chances of success are you might get a 5-10% response rate. Mm-hmm. So if you want half a dozen people, you're probably going to need 50 to 100 emails to go out. If it's a different type of service, you might have already identified particular, you know, if it's, I don't know, let's say in an organization and you want to run a diary study with different branches of that organization or different offices in different countries, then that's probably easier because you've already identified them. And then it becomes a lot easier up front. So it really depends on who your users are, really, where they are, how likely they are to engage, all of that kind of stuff.
Great. So, yeah, obviously recruitment is a big piece. Is there any way that you can make screening as easy as possible and like maximize that response rate, but also make sure that the quality of respondents is high?
Very good question. So my preference always, and this is a challenge I'm having with my current client, is to use some kind of external recruiter. Because as you know, as a researcher within a digital team, there's enough on our plates already with designing the research, running the research, analyzing the research, to also then have to go and find the people to do the research with. I would prefer to kind of outsource that, quite frankly, if I can. So what I've done in the past is engage, and not just for diary studies, but for kind of research in general, is you engage, and there's a you know, a number of, certainly in Britain, I'm sure there are all over the world, some really good organizations that are specialists in this, and you basically agree up front with them, you give them the criteria you want, and it's their job to go and find you these people, and sometimes the most really obscure brief. So one particular example, I had a service I was working on a couple of years back, was British citizens who had married Moroccan nationals in Morocco within the last 6 months.
Very specific.
And even the agency, was this recruitment agency, was saying this is going to be a very hard ask, but learn the whole thing. They found the people, and they were actually awesome. really good participants with some really valuable insights. I was going to say that's one way of doing it, and that sort of takes the load off the researcher, but still hopefully will guarantee you quality insights.
Great. Yeah, I notice I do user testing on the testing side, so I often read through a lot of screener questions, and sometimes I read the screener and I'm like, wait, you're looking for someone who owns a Toyota, speaks Korean, and is married. And I'm like, this is so specific. How do you find these people? I often wonder if these very specific demographics even show up in the screeners as participants. So it's kind of, I see that on the other side too.
Yeah, no, I agree. So like one example is the example I just gave. We use an external agency, but obviously there's a cost involved with that. And it may be in lots of projects that the client doesn't want to pay that cost, which is totally understandable because you're having to pay them to find these people. You know, social media is another one. You know, I've seen it done on Facebook as well. You can use Facebook to find people, and you can, using the kind of the Facebook targeting process, you can actually set up kind of targeted ads to the relevant demographics that you want.
Okay.
You could set up kind of surveys with screener questions built in, kind of like the ones you were talking about, where you sort of have some kind of logic in, are you a Korean speaker, yes or no, do you have a Toyota, yes or no, and you kind of filter people out that way. But obviously the more barriers you put in front of the process, the harder it will be to find the people. So it's got to be as relatively straightforward as possible.
Totally.
And the other thing to mention while I'm thinking about it is, particularly in the case of accessibility. So the particular recruiter I'm thinking about, the one we used in London, had a specialist pool of, there was another piece of work we were doing for a different project where we wanted older users, and they had a specialist pool of older users. You know, they were, most of the ones we got in were between sort of 70 and 80 in the end, and they had sight issues, they had mobility issues, and it was really valuable to kind of be able to talk to them. And of course, finding them would have been even harder using someone like social media or, you know, something like that.
That's so helpful to have that roster of participants already ready for you.
Exactly. Yep.
So screening is obviously, or rather, screening and participant recruitment is obviously a challenge. Are there any other elements to diary studies that our listeners could maybe expect if they run their own diary study?
I mean, I think we've touched on most of them. I would say, so setup is key, and that covers everything we've just talked about. I would say regular contact is key over the course of the diary study. I would also say being really frank with the participants up front about the expectation. You know, you need to say to them, we would like you to spend this much time a day, or, you know, a week doing this, and make sure they're really clear what's expected of them up front. Because if they start, they think, oh, woohoo, you know, $50 Amazon voucher, great. And then you're asking them to spend half an hour a day writing some kind of, you know, email.
Yeah.
Very quickly, they're going to go, forget this, it's not worth it.
Is the commitment worth the incentive?
Yes, correct. Exactly. And then just make it as easy as possible, you know, make it as easy for them to respond to you. And you know, and I suppose also show gratitude. You know, the yes. danger is sometimes this could become a scientific process where you're just obsessed with your results. But these are human beings. You're asking, you know, there may be an incentive, there may be not, but still they're giving up their time to provide yes. insight to you, which is valuable. Well, otherwise, why would you be gathering it? So it's important to, you know, I think show gratitude.
I think that's a really good tip. Now, let's just assume you've gone through the process of creating your diary study. All your participants have committed. You're wrapping it up and you're ready to digest everything you learned and put it in a format that's going to make sense to the people who asked you to run this diary study. How do you go about analyzing the diary study data and then extracting those insights so it's actually usable?
So that, Tracy, is the million-dollar question that every researcher has at the end of a round of research is, okay, you've got all these insights, you've got these, whether it be hours of interviews, whether it be kind of lots of survey responses, you know, how do you take all this data and turn it into something meaningful? Well, the thing with a diary study is probably you're going to end up with quant and qual data. So you're going to have, certainly in my case, we had quant data from, you know, attitudinal scales we asked people to complete, sort of, you know, hot data numbers, if I can put it like that. But at the same time, we had qualitative data in the form of, you know, text responses that people had given us. So we had free text boxes in, you know, albeit short free text boxes in the form as well. So I think, first of all, is that goes back to picking the tool. You want to pick a tool that allows you to get the information out as easy as possible. And of course, the beauty of Google Suite is that it's pretty easy to export all that stuff. So Google Forms drops it into a lovely spreadsheet that you can just export, which is what I did. And then these days, obviously, there's you know, a huge plethora, an ever-growing plethora of tools that allow you to do analysis. Back in the day, you know, my go-to process was always Miro, or could be Mural, or kind of in a similar tool. And then actually somewhat laboriously kind of getting the, let's say, getting the text quotes into post-it notes, digital post-it notes, and then kind of doing affinity mapping process, where you basically group, you get everything up on the board virtually. I mean, if you can do it in person with real post-it notes, even better. But those days feel like they're sort of gone. And then kind of grouping the post-it notes thematically to say, well, look, these are the themes which are coming out because participant 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 said this, and participant 6 and 7 said that. And that kind of handles the qual side. The quant side, well, I mean, it how does one analyze quant generally? You know, you can look at the number of ways you can do it. Probably these days kind of AI will be able to help in the future with that kind of stuff. But again, I guess it depends on thinking about the design of the study up front, how, you know, what data do you want to gather that will allow you to kind of make design decisions? That's fundamentally what it comes down to. So if you're less interested in the quant side, then probably kind of a more qualitative based approach in terms of, you know, the forms they fill in, et cetera, is better.
Mm-hmm. This is really good to, like, I'm picturing this in my mind, what that would look like as a Miro board. And my big question, and the question that I always come up with when I'm working with qualitative data, like a survey, for example, is how do you balance the knowledge that one person's opinion is one person's opinion, but at the same time, every participant counts? How do you know when something that a participant said is worth sharing as an insight?
That is a really, really good question, and it's come up actually recently again with my current client. I mean, I think that's why a technique like affinity diagramming is so powerful, because, you know, I hate that old chestnut that's always leveled at researchers around, well, you know, so if you run around a research, let's say prototype test, typically what's the Nielsen-Norman kind of metric? About half a dozen people will give you kind of the majority of the usability problems. And that's become a sort of industry standard. It's also kind of manageable in terms of, let's say, a 2-week sprint to find, interview, analyze 6 hours of you know, user feedback. But at the same time, that's not very many. And the argument can be leveled, particularly people who aren't well-versed in UX, to say, well, that's only 6 people, or that, you know, how can you possibly know from talking to 6 people? And it's a fair point. And I think with a diary study, therefore, probably you can go for a larger scale. You know, if you went for sort of twice that number, it comes down to kind of that thematic analysis at the end. And if enough people are raising the same point again and again, that's where the light bulb should be coming on. You're going, aha, this is a pain point that we need to focus on. I mean, I always frame it in terms of pain points. You know, what are the pain points that are coming out? because they're the areas we need to kind of focus on. If one person mentions something and no one else does, then, you know, don't ignore it. But it's probably not as important as if everybody's shouting, you know, raising the same pain point.
Mm-hmm. I think that's really good advice just for finding the so what of the responses in your research. So I'm going to definitely apply that to not just diary studies, but also to surveying, user testing. So thank you for that. Is there anything else about diary studies that you feel our listeners need to know before maybe creating their first diary study?
I think we've covered a lot of ground. I mean, I would say I haven't done a huge number, but the ones that I have done have been very instructive, if I can put it like that. I mean, I think probably one other thing to say is it takes a lot of time. Don't be under any illusions that to set this up, to run it, to analyze it, to kind of to make the most of the opportunity that that particular methodology gives you is not something, it's not a quick and dirty solution. So you need to go into it with your eyes open. And again, go back to the old chestnut, what do you want to learn? Because if what you're going to learn from a diary study is not what you need or want to learn, then don't do it. But if it is, then it's a very powerful way of learning that, I think.
Really good consideration. Thank you. Okay, so toughest question I'm going to ask you today. What do you have going on that you'd like our listeners to know about, and how should they find you?
Now, there's a question. Well, I mean, I think, I mentioned at the beginning, and you kindly mentioned it as well, I think Understanding Users UX podcast, that's what I spend, you know, when I'm not doing my day job, and when I'm not looking after my small children with my wife, that's what I devote kind of a lot of time to. It's something I very much enjoy. I've got to meet some great people. We've had some really great guests on the show, and we've got some great guests coming up, actually. We've got some kind of former senior product designers within Meta talking about AI. We've got, someone from NASA talking soon.
Oh, wow.
I would, you know, encourage anyone to have a look at that. And you can find me on LinkedIn as well, and my website, researchable.uk. And if they've got more questions or would like to reach out to me, then feel very free. I'd love to engage.
Love it. Thank you so much, Mike. This is a pleasure talking to you about diary studies. And thanks again for joining the show.
Thank you for having me. It's been lovely.
This is Roma Santiago from Experiment Nation. Every week, we share interviews with and conference sessions by our favorite conversion rate optimizers from around the world. So if you like this video, smash that like button and consider subscribing. It helps us a bunch.